From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Casey McDermott, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. There's a lot happening in national and even international news right now, but this morning we're going to keep it local, focusing on stories that you might have missed or might want to know more about that are playing out across the Granite State. First, we'll hear all about environmental news, protests at Merrimack Station, but also a legal protest that's being waged against New Hampshire's new PFAS regulations. We'll also check in on what's being done to deal with ongoing problems around drug addiction and homelessness in Manchester and elsewhere, and why New Hampshire in particular has been pretty slow to take up some public health-backed solutions to deal with those problems. We'll also check in on new revelations in a years-old police shooting in Claremont, ongoing challenges facing New Hampshire's schools, and a new wrinkle in New Hampshire's funding system to support Medicaid in schools. You know, these are pretty heavy topics, but we will take a moment to talk about something that's a little bit on the lighter side. There have been some moose on the loose in southern New Hampshire. We will not miss a conversation about that. These and other stories have made headlines in New Hampshire this week. We'll talk all about them in this hour. And of course, if you have questions or comments or thoughts, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Just a note, we will not be doing Facebook Live this hour because we are doing our fall fund drive, but you can, of course, tune in now and catch us on our podcast later today or online at nhpr.org. Now, here in the studio to talk about this week's news and to answer your questions are Carol Robidoux, editor of the Manchester Inklink. Thank you so much, Carol, for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
We also have Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor on the State House Politics Beat, all things public policy. Thanks, Ethan.
Glad to be here.
And for this segment in particular, we're going to start off with my colleague, Annie Ropeek, NHPR's environment and energy reporter. We'll also be joined later in the hour by a few other NHPR reporters, Daniela Ali and Jason Moon. So stay tuned. Thanks, Annie, for being here as well.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
Thank you. So we're going to, like I said, start off talking about, it was a big week on the energy and the environment beat in New Hampshire. And Annie, this week started out with kind of a bang for you. Of course, here at the Weekly News Roundup, our week runs from Friday to Friday. So this big news happened kind of too late for us to talk about it last week, but that's why we're catching up now with a bit of hindsight. You had an eventful weekend. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I covered, along with some other of our journalists, the protest at Merrimack Station, which is the coal-fired power plant in Bow, New Hampshire, right down the road from our studios. Actually, we can see it over I-93 on the rare days when it still operates. Coal and oil are really the smallest part of our fuel mix in New England, smaller even than renewables almost all the time. They mostly run on days when it's really cold or really hot. But that didn't stop hundreds of people from coming to this plant on last Saturday to protest the continued burning of fossil fuels there. And it actually ended in dozens of arrests of folks who walked onto the property of the plant as part of that protest.
So what exactly, if you were to kind of explain in simple terms, was the goal of the protest or of these demonstrations?
I think the goal was to bring attention to the fact that any fossil fuel use is still exacerbating the effects of climate change. And so, you know, just because in New England we don't think as much about coal anymore, we're not a coal-intensive region, you know, we've driven coal off the grid for the most part, that doesn't mean that it isn't still being used. And it's sort of a symbolic use. And so these were climate justice protesters. They were looking to end the burning of fossil fuels altogether. A lot of them had natural gas on their minds as well. And so, you know, they were trying to bring attention to that. I talked to some protesters, including one who ended up getting arrested. His name is Rod Monroe. And here's what he had to say about why it was worth risking arrest to protest the plant.
We're looking at saving the planet for all life, for our young, for those who have no voice. This is destroying our future, our ability to survive. We need to shut these plants down.
So you can hear in the background the sound of plastic buckets, which is what they carried. So Rod and several dozen other people marched down the railroad tracks to the plant and had these buckets with the goal of eventually getting to the storage pile of coal that's on the property and hauling it away by hand, which they also did at a protest in August. They didn't quite get that far, though.
Do you have a sense of how much coal there actually was on site that they were looking to kind of, you know, target in these demonstrations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big pile. It's like a couple years worth of stockpile that, you know, the plant burns, like I said, so rarely that They actually haven't taken a delivery of coal since Eversource sold this plant to a company called Granite Shore Power in 2018. In the past, they've taken deliveries of coal like roughly every year or so. But, you know, it's really, this is a sort of an emergency backup plant really for the grid. Like, we burned a lot of coal and oil during the 2018 cold snap, for example. But on a normal fall day like we're having today, you're not going to see that plant running. And so, you know, there was way more coal than these folks could ever have taken away by themselves in one day. But I think their goal has, the slogan of the protest has been bucket by bucket. So it's, you know, it's a symbolic effort to say, like, we will not leave this plant alone. We won't leave this fossil fuel alone until it is no longer being used, until we're transitioning to fuels that are not contributing more carbon emissions to the problem that we already have.
Now, you mentioned that this was kind of an effort of some local environmental activists. Was this part of, we've seen in recent weeks in particular, a kind of building movement across the country and across the world of environmental protests around curbing climate change, dealing with other issues facing our planet right now? Where does this fit in, if at all, to those similar demonstrations?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of the same groups that we've seen protest issues like this in New Hampshire before. And this really came at the end of that global week of climate action that was organized around the climate strikes that had been led by Swedish teenage activist Greta Thunberg. We had climate strikes take place in New Hampshire on the 20th, so the weekend before last. And then this kind of came a week later and really capped that off, you know, with a sort of more of a direct action protest, the kind you don't see so often, where folks really, I mean, there was sort of a rally and that was more family friendly. But then there was a chunk of the protesters who really took that extra step and went and got themselves arrested for this. They definitely had the climate strikes on their minds. They said they might come back to the plant the next time it takes another delivery of coal. And there are other protests like this planned around, like the Granite Bridge gas pipeline project, for example. A lot of folks, you know, there was a lot of crossover between organizations that are fighting that project, projects like it, and these folks who were in Bow last weekend.
So I do want to follow up, actually, on the kind of, you know, the involvement of law enforcement in this demonstration. You had a somewhat close encounter in your time reporting on the demonstration, and I want to come back to that. But I do just want to note that you know, I spent some time looking at your photos from the event. You can see those online at nhpr.org. One of them shows a group of about I counted maybe five state police officers in what appeared to be I'm not sure if this is the technical term, but like full tactical gear. They had vests on, they had helmets. They were surrounding a group of demonstrators who themselves were standing with kind of locked arms. It sounds like around those buckets that you were describing, Annie. You also reported that there was a police helicopter flying overhead. It was part of a large multi-state state and local law enforcement presence that spent hours monitoring the protesters. Could you just give us a sense of you know, what the concerns were on the part of police in terms of this protest?
Yeah, I mean, so I got there like an hour before it was supposed to start and immediately saw lots of state troopers in their vehicles just kind of hanging out on the road. It was, you know, the back road on the Merrimack River in Bow, and protesters were already kind of parking, lining up, walking around in the road. And the trooper I talked to just said that anytime there's this many people congregating in one place, that they want to be there to make sure everything stays safe, that it goes okay. And, you know, that was about as much as I could get out of them. I mean, I know the town of Bow was really concerned about safety. And the protesters, like, this was publicized. You know, they came there with the intention of getting arrested. It's sort of a traditional protest tactic. And so everyone was kind of on the same page in that way, I think. But, you know, this plant is on private property. There's, you know, absolutely no trespassing signs posted everywhere. Like, they're clearly worried about this kind of thing outside the context of just this protest. And so a lot of the police were stationed like on the grounds of the plant itself and were ready to meet the protesters when they arrived there, which is what eventually happened when the folks did get to the grounds of the plant. Is, you know, we had seen some police sort of stationed along the way, kind of monitoring the railroad tracks on ATVs. I had heard there were folks in the river in marine patrol boats. But the state troopers who were really in kind of heavier riot gear were coming from the plant itself. And so I don't know for sure that they were called there by the plant, or the town of Bow, I think, was leading this effort, but it really was sort of like a multi-pronged kind of situation. And I mean, frankly, this was more law enforcement than I've seen in one place in New Hampshire in the time I've been here. I don't cover stuff that attracts that kind of attention that often, but I was surprised to see it, and I think the protesters felt kind of galvanized by it. They felt like it was sort of validating, like they're scared of us, I think, was something I heard from a lot of folks.
And I just also want to note that, you noted in your reporting that you were at one point told that you may be arrested, depending on how you kind of proceeded in your coverage of and presence at this protest. What exactly happened there?
Yeah, so I was with a group of media and third-party legal observers who were tailing the protesters all the way down the railroad tracks, which was private property to begin with. We were being basically monitored by police the whole way and were sort of being allowed to be there. I mean, they had told the protesters to stop at a couple different points and just sort of as the formality of saying, okay, you've been warned, just so you know, we pull you, can't be here, you're going to continue, and that is what it is. And we got to a certain point right at the on the outskirts of the plant property where the rest of my group just kind of stopped and the protesters continued, and we hadn't been told one way or another that this was like the arbitrary line that had been drawn for media to not continue. We had already been trespassing with police supervision. So in the spirit of continuing to bear witness, I kept following the protesters until we got to the troopers who were, in their sort of heavier duty gear, at which point I was told that I would be arrested if I didn't head back over to where the rest of the folks were hanging out. So that was a new experience for me. And, we were definitely on private property, so I can understand it was like a calculated risk. But they ended up making 67 arrests total of protesters, and most of them were right around that spot, right on the edge of the plant property.
And that's quite significant for New Hampshire, at least in recent history.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think a lot of folks had protests like the Seabrook Station protests in the 70s on their mind. So some of the biggest nuclear protests in the nation's history were in New Hampshire, and there were thousands of people arrested at Seabrook, many of whom, are still environmental leaders and activists and state reps in the state today and really cut their teeth at Seabrook, which I think is interesting.
And actually, on that note, just to kind of broaden this out a little bit, we did, this obviously prompted a lot of reaction within the state, including among state policy leaders, one of whom, Senate Minority Leader Jeb Bradley, wrote an op-ed in the Concord Monitor following the protests, in which he said, I applaud the passion, the call for continued progress in creating the next generation of energy sources in New Hampshire. But Senator Bradley goes on to say the suggestion that Meramec is what it used to be or that its emissions levels from the facility are far greater than they are demonstrate either a complete lack of knowledge or a careless disregard for the facts. And I'm curious to hear either Annie or Ethan, as someone who's covering the State House and state energy debates, where does this protest fit into kind of an ongoing conversation that New Hampshire's having right now about its energy future?
Sure. So it's a bit of a complicated picture when it comes to Meramec Station. As Annie pointed out, it doesn't run very often. I think in 2017, it ran 23 days of the year. It's operating, according to my colleague Dave Brooks, who also reported on this, it's operating at 1/10 of what it was operating at in 2010. And that's just been the last 7 years. And the reasons behind that it's kind of a national trend. Coal, and you see this in stories in Appalachia, for instance, coal is just not as cheap of an energy source as natural gas has been. And so that's been the case in New Hampshire and New England, especially with fewer coal plants. But that isn't to say that it doesn't, it's not to say that it doesn't have an impact on the energy market overall. There's something called the capacity market, which essentially is even though and Annie was talking about this, saying that it kind of runs on hot days and cold days. So essentially, while New Hampshire gets most of its energy from steady sources, sometimes called base load sources, on a day when there's a high demand for energy, sometimes in the summer if it's a particularly hot day, or in the winter when a lot of the natural gas will go towards heating, the state kind of relies on these plants like Meramec to put extra energy into the system when it's needed. And in order to maintain that, there's kind of an alternative auction that's held that kind of gives these plants money. So these plants are being supported through Eversource and through kind of the rates that electric ratepayers pay to kind of act as a standby to jump in when they're needed. And so to Senator Bradley's point, he kind of raised that as a point of saying that these are necessary for those days. I think environmental activists would say there are other sources that could be used, particularly renewable energy that could be used for those days. And so it's kind of a complicated debate over whether you should keep these open for those kind of spikes in need or if there's better sources elsewhere.
We'll make an energy reporter of you yet.
I'm way out of my depth, I should say.
We could go way, way deep on this, but you know, there are a lot of other stories that I did want to get to, and especially Annie, you are always busy on the energy and environment beat here at NHPR, but in particular this week, because not only were there those protests over the weekend, but you know, we come into the actual week itself, and bam, we're hit with new PFAS regulations. So just really, really quick, let's break it down for people. What exactly are we talking about when we talk about PFAS, and what would these new rules do?
Yeah, so okay, so these are standards for drinking water on PFAS chemicals, which are these industrial substances used in things like Teflon, found in drinking water all over the state because they were so common in household products for decades. And New Hampshire has set what are really the strictest regulations of their kind in the country, which is specifically like an enforceable drinking water standard that public water systems have to meet in their regular testing regimens. And so these rules have been in the works for a couple of years now, and they finally went into effect this week. Municipal groups have been really worried about this all along because it's going to be super expensive for them to follow these rules, and there hasn't been a lot of money that's come from the state attached to it. So this week we saw a suit actually spearheaded by 3M, which is the chemical company that invented PFAS and is being sued by the state for causing the contamination. They spearheaded this lawsuit that calls these rules an unfunded mandate, asked the state to sort of redo its process for taking public input, doing the cost-benefit analysis. And they got some local water district, wastewater handlers, fertilizer companies who are also going to be affected by this kind of down the chain to sign on to that suit. And so, I mean, it was sort of expected, but it's interesting to me that it's come from 3M. I don't think I was really expecting that to happen, considering that they are also a defendant in a state suit. And so it's set up sort of an interesting situation for these local folks who are kind of caught between their mandate of keeping our water safe and providing business in the state and handling wastewater, which no one wants to deal with, and having to pay to clean this stuff up, but also work with 3M at the same time. I think it's really interesting.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Casey McDermott. Just as a reminder, you can chime in, NHPR, exchange at nhpr.org, or head over to our Facebook page and search for NHPR Exchange, all one word. Now, Annie, you were saying that you weren't really expecting to see this lawsuit, or at least this lawsuit in its particular form. How unusual is it that we would see, you know, a company like 3M team up with these kind of local, more kind of municipal entities on a legal challenge like this?
I think it's surprising. I mean, we've seen groups like 3M and DuPont, you know, the big companies that are really involved in PFAS manufacturing, get involved in these issues in other, frankly, bigger states or states that have bigger manufacturing sectors, you know, where this stuff is actually being made and used more often. Here in New Hampshire, there's really only a couple factories that really actively use PFAS or PFAS sort of successor chemicals. And we have the former Pease Air Base, where it was used in firefighting foam. So it's not like it's not being used in the state in heavy quantities. But one of 3M's defenses when they were hit with the state lawsuit was that, well, we've never made these chemicals in New Hampshire, and we're not a New Hampshire problem. And so I find it interesting that they've chosen to jump on these regulations. Again, not a huge surprise. I mean, I think a lot of critics of these regulations saw them as being kind of ripe for an unfunded mandate suit. I mean, this is sort of a question the courts are going to have to work out, because the state has just said, well, no, it's not an unfunded mandate, because your job is to safeguard water and you already had to do that. And municipal groups have said, it clearly is an unfunded mandate because you're asking us to do something new that we can't afford to do and you haven't given us any money to do it. And so, you know, I think the first year of these regulations wasn't going to be the most expensive part. So I think there's a sense of urgency here just because there's a lot of money looming out on the horizon, but I think this is going to be the start of a long process as well.
So I do want to, as much as we could spend a lot of time talking about these regulations, and Annie, you've done in-depth reporting on this, I do want to take a quick break because we have someone on the line who is going to take us to a kind of different kind of environmental story for this week. If you've been following the headlines in the Union Leader and MUR, I've seen it's made CBS in some some cases. There was a moose on the loose in southern New Hampshire this weekend, and we have a guest on the phone right now who can speak firsthand to that experience. We have Emma Paradise, who lives in Bedford. Emma, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So just to give people a sense of what this was like for you, can you just take us to the beginning? How did you come to find yourself face to face with a moose?
This whole 12-hour ordeal was totally crazy. It was, oh gosh, I don't know, the night before, so Tuesday night, I'm trying to like backtrack the time period. My husband was unloading things from the car. It was around 8:30 at night, and I was upstairs putting kids to bed. And he was looking outside at the pool, and he saw, you know, kind of a big wave. And we're like, he didn't think it was particularly windy that night, so he kind of just ignored it for a minute. It was reflecting the light on our pool house, like, and it just didn't make sense to him. So then he did a double take and ran up the stairs. It literally sounded like a herd of elephants. And it was like, there is a moose in our pool. And I was in total shock and disbelief. You know, and everyone has to repeat it about 3 or 4 times. Even as we ran to the windows, we're like, there's seriously a moose in our pool. What do you do?
So you said this took 12 hours to resolve. What exactly did you do to lead the moose out of your pool and onto safety?
Well, we called Bedford Police Department, and they sounded, it's not that they didn't believe us, but I mean, what an absurd call to receive. Hi, there is a moose in our pool. And as the police officer came in and he looked at us when we stated it, he kind of was like, are you serious? Yep, come on in. And the first thing he did was, yep, there is a moose in your pool, and took a picture of it, because it's not every day that this happens. But after some thoughtful process, we called New Hampshire Fish and Game, and they sent someone else out to the house. And a lot of people have been asking, you know, why are there no stairs in your pool? This is an older home and an older pool, and so it has a ladder in and a ladder out. And it's not like the moose could climb the ladder to get out. So that was the biggest problem, is we thought that we could try and coax him out. New Hampshire Fish and Game, they made calls, because as we all are finding out that it's mating season, to try and coax him out, encourage him to climb out, but that didn't happen. So they left our house around maybe 12:30, 1 a.m., and thought to return in the morning, and that's when they arrived with some stairs. You know, stairs that most people put out their back door to walk out if there's, you know, an elevation change.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for bringing us that firsthand account. And I just want to refer people to your Instagram, where you've been posting videos, photos of this encounter. It's impeccable_nest at Instagram. So thank you for your firsthand perspective on this. And we appreciate you joining us to kind of bring us that account.
No, thank you so much for having me. It was definitely a once in a lifetime experience.
Well, thanks so much. We'll be right back on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with lots more news to discuss in the hour ahead. Stay with us here at NHPR. Thanks so much for listening.
This is a special pledge-free stream on NHPR.org. You hear no pledge breaks to interrupt your enjoyment of the exchange this morning. NHPR is able to provide this service because of the reliable and ongoing financial support of you, our sustaining members. And with a simple command, you can access the entire world of New Hampshire Public Radio in the comfort of your home. Tune in to breaking news, all the latest podcasts, and important discussions of the day by asking your smart speaker to play NHPR. Partly sunny for today, high temperatures, lower 50s, northern New Hampshire, ranging around 60 degrees in southern parts of the state. It'll be mostly clear tonight, overnight lows from 29 degrees in the north country, ranging 38 degrees in southern New Hampshire. Saturday, a sunny day, high temperatures, upper 50s to around 60 degrees. You're listening to the special pledge-free stream on NHPR.org.
Welcome back to the Weekly News Roundup on NHPR. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're doing a little bit of a grab bag. We just got done talking about some moose on the loose, as well as some other environmental and energy stories this week. We are going to take a turn now and talk about, you know, a little more serious issues that are playing out in New Hampshire and a number of communities within the state. This morning, I'm joined by Carol Robidoux of Manchester Inklink, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. And during the break, we also were lucky enough to have my colleagues Jason Moon and Daniela Ali join us in the studio here Hello. This morning. Thank you Hi. So much, guys, for being here. So just to start off this particular section of the show, Carol, I want to go to you just to give us kind of a framework for the rest of the segment. You've been doing a lot of reporting in Manchester specifically on ongoing challenges that have been playing out there around homelessness, around other kind of social supports and services or lack thereof in many cases within the city. What kind of things were you keeping an eye on there this week?
Well, I think what we're facing at the moment is sort of a statewide crisis around homelessness. Manchester happens to be the host city of our largest shelter. And we've been seeing an increase of people, dramatic increase of people coming to Manchester and camping out and asking for shelter services. In September, there were 297 unique people who came looking for shelter. And because of all of the questions around how do we house people, where are we going to put people, last week, the Department of Health and Human Services Commissioner Jeff Myers came down personally and spent the week at the shelter with about five or six staff members. They observed and did a lot of outreach to people, and that was a success, according to Michelle Tawani, who's over at the shelter. She said that that will continue. The state is going to continue to provide some staff, supplemental staff, but they are short-staffed. They're looking to hire about six people at the shelter right now. Of those 297 people, about half of them were from Manchester, about a quarter of them were from the state of New Hampshire, and another quarter of them were from out of state. But the greater question really is, as we approach the cold weather, which we're feeling today, as a matter of fact, what are the solutions that the state is going to provide for people who need emergency sheltering? And that's the big question that is yet to be fully answered. So it's an ongoing issue, and it's hitting Manchester very hard in terms of resources and quality of life.
How novel was it that the state and state officials and state leaders actually had a presence in Manchester and at the shelter specifically this week?
I want to say it's a first in that I don't know that they have had that insider look. They've heard from our mayor, Mayor Joyce Craig, and our board of aldermen often, you know, put out there that they want the state to come. They want the state to understand what's happening. But there hasn't been a lot of meaningful response or conversation. But really now we're hitting a crisis point. And they've been sounding the alarm for a while. So this could be good. But it's also, you know, the shelter has rolled back some of its they've reduced the number of people who can stay at the shelter. So for safety reasons, they have a police presence. They had it last week. The state requested police presence, but they're going to continue that. The shelter also is adding some police detail just because the nature of excess people is can be volatile. And for everybody's safety, they're taking that turn. So there's additional expense here. But even the additional mats that they've been putting on the dining room floor is something that's not funded. So that's probably going to go away after this winter. There won't be the capacity to add 30 mats to the dining room floor. And so what is the state going to do to address that?
And even just, I mean, you know, just to reiterate, we're talking about mats on a floor for people to sleep on, not even beds.
They're not even as comfy as a yoga mat. They're sort of the foam plastic mats. You know, they're not really meant to be slept on, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. So pretty bare minimum in terms of the financial or other support that's being provided. This is also just coming after a fairly, I think it's fair to say, a rocky few months in terms of the relations between city officials in Manchester and state officials. There was kind of a war of press releases earlier this summer between city officials, the governor's office. Where does this fit into that kind of ongoing conversation about whose responsibility it is or who is really to blame for the situation that is kind of convalescing on Manchester right now?
Manchester takes the position that the great increase in humanity that's descended on Manchester is in some way related to the doorway program of services that was rolled out in January, which was part of a SAMHSA grant, two-year SAMHSA grant. And the state has taken that money and distributed it relatively evenly around the state. But Manchester has felt all along that the a majority of the resources or a larger portion of the resources should have come to Manchester. And I understand that the U.S. Drug czar, Jim Carroll, who was in town this past week in conversation with city officials, was not aware that Manchester did not receive a larger portion of these funds, which are directed at the opioid crisis and fallout from that. So he may be looking into that from a federal standpoint as to how the grant is administrated. But that is up to our governor and our Department of Health and Human Services. So having Jeffrey Myers in the city to see what is actually happening, I think, can only help Manchester's position on this.
And this is just one of a number of ways where we've seen, you know, it's one thing for state policy leaders to come up with a solution or come up with, you know, talking points or priorities around dealing with the state's opioid crisis. It's quite another to actually see programs and, you know, meaningful steps being taken to deal with those issues. Jason, I want to turn to you because you recently did some really in-depth reporting on the implementation or, you know, relatively slow pickup of syringe services in Manchester specifically, but also across New Hampshire. Why did you want to take a look at this?
Yeah, well, if you are looking at the across the sort of policy tools in any state's toolbox for dealing with addiction issues, if you look at the data, syringe services seem like a pretty good avenue to take. They've been around for a long time in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, and so there's lots of research on the effectiveness of syringe services. And they have a lot of proven benefits from the sort of initial harm reduction. They can reduce the spread of HIV, hepatitis C. They pick up dirty needles that otherwise end up on sidewalks and playgrounds and those sorts of things. But they can also have pretty profound impacts on longer-term recovery efforts. So there's research that shows that people who are participating in a syringe service program are five times as likely to enter addiction treatment programs. They're three times as likely to stop using drugs, ultimately. And so given all this data and research, I thought, well, so what's the situation like here in Manchester or in New Hampshire? And the story is basically that we're pretty far behind our neighbors. If you look at Vermont, Massachusetts, Maine, all three of those states have had syringe services since the 1990s. They've only been legal in New Hampshire for about 2 years. And the resources that they've been able to find here in New Hampshire have been fairly limited. And so right now there's five programs across the state, all in the southern half of the state. Some have been around for a little bit longer, like in Nashua has a pretty strong program that is integrated with the city public health department. There's a program on the seacoast that is pretty strong. But, you know, in Manchester, widely seen as the sort of center of the addiction crisis in New Hampshire, it has only had a needle exchange program for a couple of months, and it has struggled to get off the ground for a variety of reasons.
So let's dig into those reasons. If it is, you know, If research shows that it can be so beneficial for people in terms of getting treatment or preventing, you know, further spread of illnesses or other infections, why is it so slow to catch on in New Hampshire?
A lot of reasons. The biggest one is that, again, they've only been legal for 2 years in the state. So it starts with state policy in that respect. They also don't get any state funding in New Hampshire. They're required under law to be self-funded.
So no state funding whatsoever.
No state funding whatsoever in New Hampshire. There's limited opportunities for federal funding. Syringe services can receive federal funding, but they can't be used to buy the actual syringes. So that's a challenge. So they rely on grants, private donations. Most of the syringe services I'm aware of in New Hampshire are staffed by volunteers. You know, if you go down to Massachusetts, they're paid for by the state government. The syringe service staff are paid, you know, salaried workers. It's the same story in Vermont. So that's one issue, just sort of public funding. Another is, connected to that, it's just broader public opinion. Syringe services are generally not very popular. There's a recent poll that found just about 40% of Americans support having a syringe service in their community. So that's a barrier. And then once you get down to the actual implementation of a syringe service in a community, there are often kind of very local concerns that come up, issues like, where are you going to be distributing the syringes? Again, that's the sort of no one wants it to be right next to them. There's issues about distributing syringes in school zones, those sorts of things. And, the general perception that they can be a magnet for crime, which studies show that they actually do not increase crime. So a lot of different factors from state policy on down to very local concerns.
And Carol, I want to bring you back in with some more local perspective on this.
Yeah, I was just going to add that, I think it's also a bit political at times, because 2 years ago when this was brewing, and the mayor of Manchester at that time, Ted Gatzis, who's a Republican, those in the trenches of the addiction issues in Manchester quietly waited for a change of the guard before they brought forward, an actual plan to bring a needle exchange to Manchester, because politically it's a bit of a hot potato, and I think that extends to the community. Who's for and against. People feel like, oh, sure, just give them needles. That'll help. Let's just let everybody shoot up drugs if they want to. And I think it's the lack of understanding about the data that you bring into the question of, how many. I mean, I think I looked at the data, some of the data for last year or the past year, the number of needles, dirty needles that were exchanged was up, I don't know, threefold or something over the year before. So they're succeeding at getting dirty needles out of the community, but I don't know how much success they're having at, they can't track the disease prevention if they're not getting people tested, and that was a low number.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting data about the rollout so far. So, like, in Manchester specifically, the group Queen City Exchange that's running a syringe service there now, over the past 4 months or so, I think they've distributed about 8,000 syringes. To give you some perspective, the city of Burlington, which has less than half the population of Manchester, they routinely give out 500,000 syringes each year. So if that is any indication of the demand that is perhaps being unmet in Manchester, there is a lot of room to grow, certainly.
Now, how does Manchester just quickly compare to other cities around the state in terms of how this is being adopted?
Well, probably the best comparison to make is to Nashua, where they have a syringe service program that incorporates the city public health department with other health organizations in the area. So they have city public health officials in a mobile outreach van going out and meeting people where they are to distribute clean syringes. The program in Manchester is completely separate and outside of the city health department. They're sort of operating on their own, and even encountered some skepticism and a little bit of pushback from the city health department over concerns of, are they going to be operating this thing at the level they should be?
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Casey McDermott. And we were just wrapping up a conversation with my colleague Jason Moon about his in-depth reporting on the adoption or slow adoption of syringe services in New Hampshire and in particular in Manchester. Jason, thanks for joining us. As we move forward in this, what will you be looking for in terms of kind of next steps of this program or policy?
Well, I would just be curious to see if these syringe services take hold. So there's some that are quite new. The Queen City Exchange in Manchester just started, I believe, this April. There's a new one in the Keene area that just popped up. We've seen a couple examples before. There was one in Claremont that started and then stopped before because of concerns about school zones. So there's just given all the challenges they face, we'll be curious to see if this momentum continues to grow or if we see other syringe services sort of flame out in these communities.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Jason. We
Happy
really appreciate it. Ethan, I want to turn to you to talk about a somewhat tangential but still kind of health policy story that we've seen playing out in New Hampshire this week, this one involving Medicaid in schools. Just as kind of a baseline here, can you explain for people what that program actually is?
Sure. So you may be familiar with the program of Medicaid. It is a federal health program that's designed for low-income people. Medicare is the counterpart for older people. So Medicaid actually has, and especially in recent years, has been a lot of uses beyond just its traditional use, and one of them is schools. So there's actually a lot of services in schools that are provided to kids that, have been, especially in recent years in New Hampshire, deemed to be health services. And in 2017, before 2017, these services were specific to students that have an IEP, which is essentially this specialized plan that is sort of designed for certain students. But in 2017, they expanded that to any student who's eligible for Medicaid. So this could be everything from a speech pathologist to a psychologist to anything that the student may receive in school. The issue this spring is that the Trump administration's CMS, which is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, came down on kind of all states and gave a warning that schools should not be using this money. They should not be getting this reimbursement, because what happens is the student will get the service and then the school will get 50% of that back from the federal government. And that's a huge boost to school budgets. But the Washington was telling New Hampshire, which was trying to expand this, that you can't get this reimbursement unless you're doing this through the Medicaid program, and that means that everybody needs to be kind of certified to be able to accept Medicaid billing, and it means a whole bunch of other hoops. And the kind of threat that was given to New Hampshire and by Washington is if you're out of compliance, we might have to pull the program entirely. So that's the situation that the state found itself in. So the state passed an emergency rule this August, right before the start of the school year. And I should also note, right before towns start setting their taxes, which is a really important part of this. So the rule said to schools, you have to make sure that all of your services are in line. The problem, and this is a widespread problem, I've been talking to schools this week, is that getting in line with this new rule is actually quite difficult, because a lot of these services are not, they haven't been built to be, able to take in Medicaid payments. And that means, so there's a whole bunch of hoops they now have to jump through in order to keep this funding. For a lot of schools, this is a lot of money. For Concord, it's about $1 million. I've heard like millions in other school districts. And so they're all kind of scrambling right now to figure out what to do to meet these new rules that are basically being handed down by Washington.
So we'll touch base on kind of what the next steps are on this program and this what sounds like a very complex and challenging situation after the break. Stay with us here on NHPR. We're going to come back for that discussion, as well as a discussion about the kind of revisiting of a pretty difficult situation in Claremont a few years ago. I'm Casey McDermott. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we will. We'll be right back.
How was your week?
Vicious.
We're not fooling around here, though.
Vicious.
You give the American people a choice between freedom and socialism.
When people are buying ads and they're paying you in rubles,
they're going to choose freedom every time.
Questions remain over who asked whom to do what, and whether that included snakes and alligators at the southern border. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
The pledge-free edition of the Friday News Roundup, this morning at 10 here on the special pledge-free stream on NHPR.org. Partly sunny for today, high temperatures, lower 50s in northern parts of the state, ranging lower 60s in the south. Mostly clear tonight, we'll have lows from 29 degrees in the north country, ranging to 38 degrees in southern New Hampshire. Saturday, sunshine, high temperatures, upper 50s to around 60 degrees. It'll be mostly cloudy, a chance of showers Sunday, with high temperatures upper 50s to the mid-60s. You're listening to the special pledge-free stream on NHPR.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Casey McDermott. I'm here with a panel of esteemed colleagues, esteemed reporters from across the state in here right now. And we're going to pick up with a conversation that we started before the break with Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Ethan was telling us about these kind of a new wrinkle in the Medicaid to Schools program that's causing a lot of challenges for districts across the state. Ethan, just to pick up on that, so where does this leave school districts and I guess in by extension, you know, local communities and local taxpayers in terms of dealing with these new changes?
The short answer is nobody has any idea.
Well, that's comforting.
Yeah. So I've talked to a lot of superintendents in the last few days, and everybody is telling me different things. So just to recap, this money does bring a lot. This program brings a lot of money to schools, and it reimburses things for things like special education teachers for the deaf, paraeducators, school counseling, speech language specialists, lots of services that students get. And schools have factored in to their budgets that they gave to the Department of Education earlier this year that they would get this money. This kind of guidance coming down from Washington, and that's now been interpreted by the State Department of Health and Human Services, is very new for everybody. Most of them weren't told until September. And so now they're scrambling because as of October 1st, tax rates are getting set for towns. So our Department of Revenue Administration takes in the budgets that that parents and, you know, residents of towns pass, and then they use that to determine the tax rates. Now, a lot of these schools are facing hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not million-dollar holes. And so people are taking different approaches. Some administrators say, we're going to take the cautious approach. We're going to write off this money. We're just going to assume we're not going to get it. You know, these are big hoops for us to jump through to get these new kind of to meet the federal standards. So we're just not going to assume we're going to get it. We'll budget around it, which is, a bit of a difficulty for them. Some schools, like Franklin, the Franklin School District, and Concord, say, well, we have a little bit of time until the tax rates are set in October. We're going to see if we can get this, actually get ourselves into compliance. But here's what you need to do to get into compliance. You need to get now for kids who are eligible for Medicaid and are receiving these services in school, you need to get a parental consent form. You need to get one of the students' medical professionals, whether that's a pediatrician or whatnot, to sign off on it as well. And you need to get everybody who works in your school to be into compliance with their respective boards. A lot of them are licensed through the Department of Education. That's not good enough anymore. For instance, if you're a physical therapist or you're a psychologist, you now need to be licensed through the New Hampshire Board of Psychology. This is a lot of steps. So basically, every school is trying to do it differently. The Department of Health and Human Services is trying. The governor, Chris Sununu, has said that he's trying to work with Washington, but it's a little bit of a mess right now, and it's not going to be clear until these tax rates are set. And every town could be different. And some have said, yes, this could raise tax rates. Some have said, we're not sure yet. We're getting some more money. It's really kind of all over the place.
That sounds like a complicated situation that will take a while to resolve. So we'll keep tuned in to the Concord Monitor and to your reporting, Ethan, on that in the months to come. I do want to turn to another topic that we saw this week. Daniela, my colleague, is here in the studio with us, who was doing some reporting on a new revelation involving a police shooting or an officer-involved shooting in Claremont a few years ago. Daniela, can you just tell us a little bit about the actual incident itself before we get into kind of this new update?
Sure. So in September of 2016, Cody LaFont, he had called the police department a couple of times that morning. Corporal Ian Kibbe responded to that call, and in the span of about a minute, Kibbe said that LaFont had kind of like brandished a handgun and refused a number of orders to drop it, and so Kibbe feared for his life and fired 3 shots, ultimately killing Cody LaFont. And in following that, the Attorney General's office found that that was legally justified. That shooting was legally justified.
So people might hear that phrase legally justified and they might wonder, what exactly does that mean? Could you explain to us?
Sure. So basically that means that the Attorney General's office found that the officer was acting in conformance with the law and that the law supported what he was doing, basically. And this week, we can kind of get into this. Yeah.
So just to move into that, so they reevaluated that justification this week in light of some new developments that have happened since that shooting took place. Correct.
Yeah. So in a separate incident, the officer, Ian Kibbe, was found guilty of falsifying documents related to a police search. And so he was convicted of those crimes in December of 2019. So kind of in light of that, and the attorney general say, you know, in light of the crimes that Mr. Kibbe committed that implicated his credibility as a police officer, they wanted to reexamine this case. So they found they revised their conclusion. So they said this is no longer legally justified, but we're going to say we can't disprove his claim of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
So they're not saying that, just to be clear, because I think this might be confusing for people, particularly with all of the kind of jargon that we're talking about. Are they saying that it was not justified?
So that, yeah, I think that there's a little, like, getting into the specifics a little bit, is that they're saying they're, because his credibility has been called into question, they cannot be confident that he acted in conformance with the law.
Got it.
But they cannot also be confident that if they were to bring a criminal charge against him, that they could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did not act in self-defense. So that's kind of what they're laying out there.
So it's kind of in a limbo in between whether or not it was, in fact, in the eyes of the Attorney General's office, justified to use this deadly force in that scenario.
That would be my understanding of it. Yeah.
How unusual is it for the AG's office to step back and take another look at a case like they did in this instance?
So the union leader reported that there has been no instance previously of the state reversing a finding that a shooting was legally justified. You know, over the past 2 decades, law enforcement in New Hampshire has used deadly force about 46 times, and a little less than half of these incidents have been fatal.
Now, this is not the only kind of new update in this case. You also reported that the family of the man who was killed in this shooting has actually filed a civil suit. Could you tell us a little bit more about that lawsuit? And it sounds like that's actually a pretty pretty unique situation as well.
Sure. So the Valley News first reported that the estate of Cody LaFont had filed a suit, I think, a day before the statute of limitations ran out. And so they are suing the city of Claremont, Officer Kibbe, and his supervisor as well. So they are claiming that Kibbe used excessive force and that Cody LaFont was the victim of discrimination. And so specifically that he faced disability discrimination because there was a failure to accommodate mental illness, and disability discrimination by failure to train and supervise the police force.
How based on your understanding of the situation in Claremont right now, how is the Claremont Police Department responding either to these specific updates or just generally in terms of kind of training or providing support to its officers to deal with people who might be in distress, as it sounds like Cody LaFont may have been in this particular instance?
Yeah, so I talked with Police Chief Mark Chase yesterday, and he said he wasn't going to comment on the specifics of this case, but he did mention that, you know, there are several policies in place that address, you know, mental illness, substance use, all sorts of things. He did say that there isn't just like one policy that's like, well, you know, A, B, C, D, E, here's the exact steps that you need to take in particular situations. He did say that they do have an annual use of force training, though, for their police force, and do a number of other trainings as well.
And I do want to refer people to some reporting that was done by my colleague Jack Rodolico a few years ago. Jack took a look at some of the incidents of other police shootings that have happened over recent decades, did a really deep dive, a data-driven look at when force is used, in what situations, and also took a look at some new training and some new approaches to helping police, helping law enforcement and first responders deal with people who may be under duress or maybe, you know, not responding in a, you know, in a kind of calm, collected way so that they can avoid escalating the situation further. So I want to refer people to nhpr.org. We'll have that in our post for today's show. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Casey McDermott. And just coming back to pick up on that conversation that we were just having with Daniela, Ethan, you had something that you wanted to add here.
Yeah, I just wanted to note this is something that has come before the legislature. They've noted it. And the budget passed this last month actually includes funding for a new position at the Department of Justice whose sole responsibility would be to investigate deadly force, officer-involved deadly force cases, as they call it. And interestingly, also that position, when not investigating these cases, would be to train local law enforcement officers, which we'll have to see how that goes. In addition to Jack, my colleague Alyssa Dandry has also done a deep data dive of officer-involved shootings and found that the majority, I think it's the vast majority, if not all of them, have been deemed justified by the Department of Justice. So it would be very interesting, especially in this kind of national political climate, if you have a full-time investigator who's actually dedicated to it, whether that might change that kind of balance.
I would just add to that, too, that, you know, we see that in Manchester now, a partnership with the Manchester Mental Health and the deployment of the mobile unit. But I think, again, it's like a lot of these issues that we're touching on today are mental health related, and yet we don't really have the resources that we need. Police officers aren't social workers, and they're not mental health workers. And I know in that case that you were talking about in Claremont, that was something that struck me, that he was known to the police and probably much of the community as someone who had chronic issues with calling for help or I mean, just that, saying it like that, you know, a call for help. What kind of help do you receive when you pick up that phone, and what is the appropriate response? So as we investigate use of force, we should also really make an issue of how we're responding to human need.
That's an excellent point, and especially kind of brings it full circle with the other issues that we've been talking about this hour, and frankly for, I think, years.
Yes.
Here on NHPR and other local news outlets, there's a lot of kind of interconnectedness to the issues of kind of law enforcement, mental health, drug issues that are playing out across New Hampshire today. Daniela Ali, thank you so much for joining us. What else will you be looking for either in the weeks ahead on this story or otherwise on your beat?
Yeah, I'm just looking to see how the community of Claremont is responding to this, and maybe seeing like what other trainings police forces in the Upper Valley have available to them.
Thanks so much. And Carol, what else will you be keeping an eye out in the week ahead?
Everything.
What won't you be keeping an eye out on the week
yeah,
ahead?
Yeah, really just, I mean, the shelter issue, it sort of touches a lot of other issues in Manchester. So as the big city, I just received a list as we speak, you know, from the state about what emergency beds are available. So I'm going to be working on a story about that to kind of take a look at what's really out there and what we need to do in time for the snow.
Great.
And the cold.
Thank you so much, Carol. Check out the website Manchester Inklink. You can find all of her reporting and her staff's there. Ethan, how about you?
I think I'm probably going to keep looking at these schools and kind of how the towns and schools in New Hampshire react to the budget funding they're getting. They're getting a lot of money from the budget, but obviously this Medicaid thing adds some complications, so we'll just see how everything shakes out.
I want to thank everyone for being a part of this conversation. We covered a lot of ground, so thanks so much for being along for that ride. That's it for today. Remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Casey McDermott. Thanks so much for listening.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Have you noticed streets and train stops, they're almost always named after men? A new subway map in New York reimagines that.
It's fabulous fun now all the time to think about getting around the city by saying, I'm going to get on the train at Grace Jones and get off at Yoko Ono. It matters to see people we recognize and admire recognized in public.
That's next time on Here and Now.
The Pledge Free edition of Here and Now, this afternoon at noon, here on the special Pledge Free stream on NHPR.org. You've been listening to The Exchange on a special pledge-free stream on NHPR.org. Special thanks to our sustaining members for your regular and continuous support of the station that keeps New Hampshire connected to itself and the world. Coming up, it's 1A Uninterrupted, thanks to your support. Partly sunny for today, high temperatures lower 50s, northern New Hampshire ranging to around 60 degrees in southern parts of the state. It'll be mostly clear tonight, overnight lows from 29 degrees in the North Country, ranging 38 degrees in southern New Hampshire. Saturday, it'll be sunny, high temperatures upper 50s to around 60 degrees, and mostly cloudy, a chance of showers Sunday, highs upper 50s to mid-60s. You're listening to the special pledge-free stream on NHPR.org.
Did you know that when you're watching TV, your TV is watching you? I'm Ira Flatto on the next Science Friday, how your smart TV is collecting information about you, and so are the other Internet of Things devices in your home. Who's using your personal data and why? All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
The pledge-free edition of Science Friday this afternoon at 2 here on